Welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Director Ava DuVernay has taken on a project that a lot of people considered nearly impossible, a film adaptation of A Wrinkle in Time. The Madeleine L'Engle novel is a classic, and DuVernay lined up no less than Oprah Winfrey to play its wisest character, Mrs. Winch.
Reese Witherspoon, Mindy Kaling, Chris Pine, and Zach Galifianakis are also on hand for this journey. So are some talented newcomers. I'm Stephen Thompson.
And I'm Linda Holmes. We're talking about A Wrinkle in Time on today's Pop Culture Happy Hour. Also with us is Glenn Weldon of the NPR Arts Desk. Hi, Glenn.
Hey, Linda.
And from member station WAMU right here in Washington, Daisy Rosario. Hi, Daisy.
Hey, Linda.
It's so good to have you back so soon.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
We are excited to see you. Let's explain a little bit about what A Wrinkle in Time is. So you have a girl named Meg Murray, and she's junior high age. Mm-hmm. And her father is a scientist who has vanished while investigating ways to travel through the universe. So he's been gone for several years, and she, one might say, receives the call to go and find her father. She teams up with her younger brother, Charles Wallace, who's sort of an odd...
Young Sheldon.
Yeah. but a sort of a precocious, high energy, and potentially sort of mystical little kid. Mm-hmm. And also her new friend from school, Calvin, who's sort of her, not boyfriend exactly, but the boy who
There's
is
something there.
Befriending her. Mm-hmm. And they go off to look for her father with the help of the Mrs., as they call them. Mm-hmm. Mrs. Witch, that's Oprah Winfrey, and Mrs. What's-It, that's Reese Witherspoon, and Mrs. Who is Mindy Kaling, which I think is one of the very interesting pieces of casting in the film, because it's not really what I think of Mindy Kaling doing. It's a very straight role. Very quiet. Mm-hmm. She doesn't talk very much. You're not getting your Kelly Kapoor chatterbox.
There's a twinkle there.
Yeah, there is. Glenn, what did you think of the film?
Well, first off, I did love these books as a kid. I devoured them when I was 8. I kept rereading them. And the fourth book in this series, Many Waters, came out when I was 18. So I read it when I was 18. And I really thought, wow, there's something missing here. And then I went back and reread the entire series. And it just really struck me as very thin. Just narratively thin from a conflict point of view. Mm-hmm. So I was curious about how Ava DuVernay would enrich this story, because it could use some enriching, in my opinion. And she invests it with all these really visually inventive scenes. And certainly, I would say what this film represents literally is really admirable. It's an affirmation of childhood. It's a very matter-of-fact affirmation of people of color in a way we don't see a lot, in small ways and large. All those lines about Meg's hair is in there for a reason, and it's doing really good work.
Mm-hmm.
In the closing minutes of this film, also, you will not see childhood affirmed and people of color affirmed and the uniqueness of someone and their flaws celebrated in this way. And not for nothing, really well lit. It's really, really
it's
well lit throughout
pretty.
This film.
Yeah.
So I would say if you got a kid, any race, any sex, any gender, you should go and see this film. This is filled with great messages for kids. The question before me is, what if you're not a kid? Mm-hmm. Or what if you're a kid like me who was 36 at age 11, right?
Yeah.
Because, you know, I don't know, Daisy, did you see the screening with us where there was a trailer before it with Ava DuVernay kind of talking to us?
Yes.
Okay.
I did see that.
She basically says there, this film is about the 12-year-old kid in all of us. It's not for cynics. And, you know, basically 11-year-old Glenn, 12-year-old Glenn would react to a movie that includes the line, love is the frequency, the same way that 50-year-old Glenn did.
Yeah,
which is like,
I get it.
I want to, I can't go on this journey
there
with
you. There are 12-year-old cynics.
I just can't go on this journey with you. Mm-hmm. But, again, I really admire it, and I think kids should see it. Maybe not for Glenn's.
Yeah, I getcha. What do you think, Daisy?
I really enjoyed it, but it's very much a kid's movie, mm-hmm. right? I mean, it is a movie for children, and I don't mean that in a bad way. I just think, you know, the current number one movie is still Black Panther. People think of superheroes and they think of kids, but really with the themes you could play with there, it can really play to all ages. This is definitively a kid's movie. And so I did enjoy it. I think I was actually a very cynical 12-year-old who has grown up into a bizarrely whimsical late 30-something, probably in part thanks to Oprah, which I'm sure we'll talk more about.
Mm-hmm.
But in that sense, I really did enjoy it. I have a 12-year-old sister. I think she's going to really enjoy it when I take her to see it. And I was sitting next to a girl that was definitely somewhere between 10 and 12, who as soon as the lights went down, just was so thrilled, was so excited, mm-hmm. was shaking in her chair. And then as soon as the credits came up, just went, oh my God, I loved it. It was so good. Like she just, as if it was, she was vomiting her excitement out. So in that sense, I do think it works. but it's more children's movie than family movie, I would say.
Oh, I get that. Interesting. How about you, Stephen?
I had much the same reaction. I felt that my viewing experience was really enhanced by that intro that we got where Ava DuVernay gets up and tells you, here is the mindset you should have when you're seeing this movie. I actually could use that more in other movies, because I really then tried to watch this movie through the eyes of a child and through the eyes of particularly my 14-year-old daughter, who was a little cynical for this movie. But I really appreciated looking at it as a kid's movie. First of all, Ava DuVernay knows how to frame a shot. Mm-hmm. She is an incredibly skilled director and an incredibly skilled kind of visual technician. So you have this beautiful imagery and kind of otherworldly imagery throughout this film that I thought was really beautiful. And then you have this very nice mix of fantasy and reality, where you bring in elements of our real lives, like bullying in school or Oprah looming over us and telling us how to live our lives. And then you have elements of fantasy, you know, like they're spiriting around the universe and there's an adolescent girl who doesn't think her father is a jackass. you know, I enjoyed that kind of swirl of fantasy and reality. I love that Ava DuVernay's equivalent of product placements is to, instead of like a bag of Doritos, you have a photo of James Baldwin.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, it's really true.
She peppers in as many faces and names. At one point, Gugu Mbatha-Raw, who plays the mom, mm-hmm. is sitting there reading a book about, I think, Native Americans?
Yes. Yeah, yes. Native American Native women.
Native American women. Mm-hmm. And so there's just this constant little Easter eggs of Ava DuVernay's view of the world. And the movie reflects that. The lessons of the movie, you have your boilerplate believe in yourself, but as you said, Glenn, there's also more like making your flaws strengths mm-hmm. that I really appreciated as a dad, and I'm curious to see what my daughter thinks of it. I think she's too cynical.
It's interesting because I'm trying to figure out what it says about me that all of you are basically coming down saying, like, it's good as long as you're a small child. And I'm basically like, I loved it. But I really, really enjoyed it very, very much. I definitely did think it was beautiful to look at. And I think they made a very wise decision that the fantasy sections, when they are getting heavily into things that involve a lot of computer animation and things like that, to me, it has a sort of heightened intentional unreality that makes the imperfections in computer animation matter less. Mm-hmm. When we saw BFG, there's a real effort to have that be as photorealistic as possible. Mm-hmm. And I felt like it only made it more obvious when it, you know, when it's not. This, I think, embraces the fact that it's very much heightened. And so that's part of why you get these very extravagant costumes on the misses, which change every time they go to a new place. You get a new set of costumes and a new lip color on Oprah and all that stuff. But the first thing I said coming out of this movie was a lot of this is going to turn on whether you can accept or not accept the idea of wisdom delivered by a giant glowing Oprah. Yeah. And if that is just beyond the pale for you, if that is a bridge too far for you, which I understand, you're going to struggle with the movie because it is incredibly earnest and sincere, which is one of the things I really love about it. It is one of the least cynical children's movies. It is one of the least cynical movies I have seen in a long time. Mm-hmm. It doesn't feel workshopped to me. It doesn't feel made by committee. It feels deeply and intensely personal. And I love the fact that I think of Ava DuVernay as a very practiced skeptic in the sense that she made 13th, which is mm-hmm. about the prison system. Yeah. She made Selma, which really interrogates our understanding of the history of the civil rights movement. And yet, I think she's skeptical, but able to be completely uncynical, particularly when dealing with kids. And I think that's mm-hmm. a very good distinction to draw, and to see her make, with all of that visual imagination that she has, to see her really step forward and say, for kids, you can make something that is earnest. It is not tempting the parents with archness or the things that they really want. It is earnest because it is genuinely for kids.
Well, it's very loving. I think she has a very loving view of childhood. And like one of the key themes of this movie is just seeing the potential in young people, is seeing the potential in these characters. And she's clearly fascinated by that. And that, I think, is where you do have a through line with her other films, is she wants everybody to have an equal opportunity to rise up and be their best self. And this movie really takes that argument and directs it toward kids. She's kind of speaking directly to kids in a way that, like I said, as a dad, I appreciate.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about the book. Glenn, sure. You were saying that you were attached to these books.
Yeah, I was. I loved them. Madeleine L'Engle was a hugely successful author, but maybe didn't get the respect that many feel she deserved because she worked between two poles. Her work was powered by, infused by, colored by her deep Episcopalian, but very ecumenical, very Unitarian, very pluralistic Christian faith, right? It wasn't the kind of Christian faith that animates the Narnia books by C.S. Lewis, which is very sort of didactic.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an elaborate allegory. And as soon as you find the key that turns the lock, the game's over, right?
It's Christian, but it's less prescriptive.
Exactly.
Than a lot of Christian-type themed books.
And because of that, you can walk into a Christian bookstore and get, you know, hit in the face with Narnia, but in many Christian bookstores, you still don't find Madeleine L'Engle. On the other opposite of the extreme are book critics of science fiction and fantasy who would always, you know, you'd read the reviews and at the end of it, be like, it's a little cheesy. It's a little, you know, it's a lot. Because, you know, in the book, for example, there's this whole scene where the centaurs, who are not present in the movie, spout quotes from Psalms and Isaiah. Like, there's biblical stuff all over the place. That animating principle is not present in the movie. For example, there's a key scene that proved to be a very controversial scene in the book where the character of Mrs. Hu, played by Mindy Kaling, is listing the warriors for Earth who have been, you know, lit up by the past. And she starts listing and she goes, Einstein, Gandhi, the Buddha. And if you know the books, you're waiting for it. J-Man. We're going to get the J-Man pretty soon. And it doesn't come. She doesn't say Jesus. She goes on because Ava DuVernay has replaced the very, as I say, pluralistic religion of the books with our contemporary equivalent, Oprah. This is, there are so many shots of Oprah gazing beatifically with munificent benevolence upon Meg or anybody. So there was one point I remember thinking, oh man, Meg's going to get a car. Like, because it's just this, that's what the movie is. It's animated by her ethos. It's replacing, in a really interesting way, the light versus dark, love conquers evil, with not self-love, but.
It's a kind of humanism.
It's exactly. Yeah, it's an Oprah's version of humanism.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah.
How about you, Daisy? Where do you come down on all this?
Well, I'm very pro-Oprah in general, but I would agree with that. I would say, and this is not at all an insult, but I do not feel like Oprah is acting in this movie. Like, she is just being Oprah with lots of great costumes and makeup, right? Like, she is just above us, looking down, very concerned about our spirits, just trying to get us to live our best lives by embracing the negative as well as the positive.
There's very little that Oprah says in this film in character that she wouldn't say as
right.
herself.
Right, absolutely. Like, there are shots where I'm just like, those could have been taken while they were setting up for the next shot. Like, she was just standing there, and they took a shot of her beaming at the world.
Yeah.
And I do not have a problem with that, just to be clear. Like, I really enjoyed that aspect of it. And, yeah, I mean, that to me is part of what I mean when I say that it's a kids' movie, and it feels like Oprah Light. Like, how do you make that thing accessible? We don't have the Oprah show in the afternoons anymore. Increasingly, people don't have cable. So, you know, kids aren't watching OWN necessarily the way that I happened into Oprah after school at times. And so it felt like this infusion of the Oprah I grew up with. And honestly, like, I'm glad to have her back. She wasn't gone, but it didn't feel like she was around the way she is right now.
Well, when they recently had a moment on the Ellen show, when Ellen brought out Oprah to talk to Tiffany Haddish, she was talking about the influence of Oprah on her, it really made me think about the fact that I think there is a kind of generational echo of women who are now in their 30s, perhaps coming into their kind of greatest power as artists and whatever, who want to talk about the significance of Oprah, not the kind of the way Oprah was kind of perceived as a, you know, guru of housewives or whatever the stereotype would have been, but how deeply important her show, her presence was to a lot of young girls, a lot of them Black, a lot of them not. And not only had I just seen that Tiffany Haddish clip, but I had just had a conversation with my own medical doctor, who happens to be a Black woman who I think is probably in her 30s, who was talking to me about how much she loves Oprah and how important Oprah was to her. So to me, the presence of Oprah here, although it seems so over the top, like Glenn says, it's like you have the closest thing to God is Oprah. Mm-hmm. There is a way in which I think the place that Ava DuVernay is coming from in putting her in that position is so genuine. And I think it's very much the way that Oprah felt about Maya Angelou.
Yeah.
Now,
mm-hmm. Oh yeah,
I'm not saying Oprah is Maya Angelou. What I'm saying is I think the same kind of respect for the people who were important to you. And I think that having Oprah in that role, even Oprah in the sky, I was able to like embrace. And I liked the fact that you also had it really lightened up by this very, I thought, pleasantly daffy Reese Witherspoon turn that I enjoyed a lot. There's not a lot to it, but I read an interesting interview with her where she sort of said, I've done what I aspire to do with acting. She's doing a lot of producing now. And she sort of said, you know, I'm not worried about acting necessarily. I want to do things that I like doing. And this felt to me like something that you might do just because what a great thing to be able to say you did. You were Mrs. What's It with Oprah and Mindy Kaling.
Yeah.
Like, that's really fun.
Yeah, I mean, I guess my only thing about Oprah, specifically in the context of this movie, is that it does make it harder to suspend disbelief. Like, you know, when you're watching a movie, it's great to get completely immersed in it and kind of forget that you're watching actors acting. And, you know, that's obviously trickier to do with some actors than others because some actors are so big and iconic that you know you're watching Tom Hanks in The Post or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's really hard to forget that you're watching Oprah. And so that, you know, kind of pulled me out of the movie occasionally. I think her performance, like you said, Daisy, she's Oprah as herself. A looming guru.
She's just always at peace in that way. Yep. And that's what she's radiating.
But I think in this film, I found I was more attached to some of the less familiar faces. I really like Storm Reid's performance in that central role. And think about how quickly this movie just topples if that kid isn't magnetic. Magnetic and yet adolescent and therefore sullen. You know, in some ways very interior, very quiet, but still a kid that you're drawn to that you instantly root for.
And she has to really ground that entire movie, which has so many great big elements.
Yeah.
I mean, it has a giant Oprah. And she has to hold her own.
Well, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. I think that's right. And, you know, one of the things that I thought was so sweet about this film, we talked about this a little bit on the way out, is that I did cry at this movie quite a bit, but not just at the kind of the obvious emotional climactic moments. I found myself tearing up a couple of times based on what wasn't really joy or sadness or the ordinary things that make me cry. It was just truth. It was just the opening up of something that made me feel like, oh, they're just putting their finger directly on something that I have felt so many times in childhood and in adulthood. And so I loved it. It's the little tiny child in me, which apparently never left.
You know, there are a lot of fantastic elements here. But as we were talking about how she frames a shot, this film lives in close-ups. Over and over again, we see characters staring down the barrel of the camera straight at us in really, really tight close-ups in a way that you don't see often. So that's I think, what kind of keeps it grounded and real to the extent that it is.
Yeah. Well, I definitely want to hear what all of you think about A Wrinkle in Time. Come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet us at PCHH. When we come back, it's going to be time for our favorite segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? So come right back.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from WordPress.com. WordPress.com offers e-commerce options that range from an effective buy button to a complete online store, as well as code-free site building, so you don't need a professional designer to get your website up and running. If you need help, WordPress has a customer support team that is available 24/7. Learn more and get 15% off any new plan purchase at WordPress.com/happyhour. Support for this podcast and the following message come from ABC. Presenting American Idol, the singing competition that started it all, has a new home on ABC. And the journey to find the next great American singing sensation is about to begin. Superstar judges Luke Bryan, Katy Perry, and Lionel Richie join host Ryan Seacrest in the search to find your next American Idol. Premieres Sunday, March 11th at 8, 7 Central on America's Network, ABC.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It is time for our favorite segment of this week. And let's face it, every week. What is making us happy this week? Stephen Charles Thompson. What is making you
hitting
happy?
Hitting him with the trivia.
Sorry, is that going to allow someone to steal your identity?
Stephen, Social Security number. You know, sometimes, you know, we give recommendations in this segment that are very near and dear to our hearts. This is not necessarily one of those times. But I had such a goofy laugh sitting down with a bunch of YouTube segments by an actor named Hunter Davis, whose shtick on YouTube is that he does a spot-on impersonation of Ian McKellen. And he uses his ability to spot-only impersonate Ian McKellen by having fake Ian McKellen recite song lyrics. Particularly the one that I brought is him doing DuckTales.
Might solve a mystery or rewrite history. DuckTales. Woohoo.
At one point he started no. It's so goofy. Hat tip to Laura Olin's newsletter for recommending it and sending me down this ridiculously stupid rabbit hole. He also does Baby Got Back
and sure he does.
The theme from The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air and Bohemian Rhapsody, and it's just fun.
I gotta get a gimmick, man.
No. But it's a gimmick with really no downside. Once you're tired of it, you just watch something else.
Thank you very much, Stephen Thompson. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
There's a film called Game Night. It's been out for like 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. Stars Jason Bateman, Rachel McAdams, Jesse Plemons, Sharon Horgan, Kyle Chandler. Look, I don't want to oversell this, but it legit surprised me. I reviewed it for NPR, went in thinking I know what this is going to be, because the plot is Game Night goes bad. That's the entire plot. I thought it was going to be like Horrible Bosses or Office Christmas Party, you know, raunch fest with, you know, fair to middling jokes. It's smarter and funnier than that. I'm recommending it now because it's been out 3 weeks. It's about to disappear. If you want to see it before you can see it on a plane, you should see it now.
Got kind of gobbled up by Black Panther now.
Yeah. Got gobbled up by Black Panther, but it actually is doing relatively mm-hmm. well. And I think that's entirely based on A, my review, but B, word of mouth. I think this is the kind of film that really benefits from word of mouth. I'm also bringing it up because just this morning I was listening to the Slate Culture Gap Fest, which I love and I think of as our smarter, more buff older brother, no tea, no shade, but they liked it. But one of the critics, Metcalf, basically said it works because all these jokes that are in it feel like they were just the product of studio punch-up, like a room where somebody goes and script doctors and just throws in extra jokes, and they do a really good job of doing that. And this thing where you scream at a podcast, I did the thing where you scream at a podcast, and now I have some recourse. I can actually scream to you about how that's exactly the opposite of what's going on in that movie. And I even called this out in the review. These jokes, and this thing is filled with them, the jokes, the references, the pop culture references they're making grow out of the fact that these characters are trivia nerds, right? Mm-hmm. So everything is grounded. Everything is organic. Nothing feels cynical and just thrown in. It all feels like it grows out of who these characters are and what they're about to do. Why they're seeing the world, their situation through the scrim of pop culture is because that's just who they are. We all know people like that, and this film's about them. Don't go thinking it's the second coming. It's just a surprisingly funny, smart little film, Game Night.
Thank you very much, nice. Glenn Weldon. Daisy Rosario, what is making you happy this week?
I have been reunited with a show that I watched growing up, and I've been very excited to rewatch it. I was a big, big fan when I was about 12 or 13. That tells you a lot about what kind of kid I was, of Homicide: Life on the Street.
Wow.
I was a very intense child, a very cynical child. I had a really big crush on Bayless.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Just like in the original show, we both turned out to be bisexual. Who knew? but I love that show, and I think it's a big part of why I even love Brooklyn Nine-Nine as much as I do, like having grown up with Andre Brauer in that incredibly intense role for which he was awarded heavily and critically acclaimed, rightfully so. It was very fun to watch him, you know, on Brooklyn Nine-Nine or still watch him on that show. So I have been rewatching Homicide: Life on the Street. I am not terribly far into my rewatch, but it has been a treat to go back to it. And I also want to mention how I found it again, which is I got a library card. And my library card is making me very happy as well. I can't say that I would go to a Best Buy and buy DVDs. I barely have a working DVD player, but seeing it on the shelf at the library, I said, oh my gosh, yeah, Homicide. I will absolutely rewatch this. Nice. So not only am I enjoying the show, but I am enjoying the wonderful things that come with having a library card, which I highly recommend if you can support your local library.
You have learned how to pander to our audience.
They're readers. She didn't even do that on purpose.
I don't think
Daisy even knows that librarians are one of our core demographics.
I did not.
See?
Guys, yeah. I meant that sincerely for you, the way Ava DuVernay sincerely means A Wrinkle in Time.
It's true. Thank you very much, Daisy Rosario. But what is making me happy this week, few of my film Twitter pals mentioned that the streaming service Filmstruck had picked up a bunch of classic Hollywood movies and added a bunch to its library, and so I tried them out. And I have been very much enjoying scrolling through that library. The first thing that I watched from them was The Umbrellas of Cherbourg, which is one of the kind of French Jacques Demy musicals that La La Land is actually referencing even more than Hollywood musicals of the 40s and 50s. So I enjoyed that very much. They have a really nice collection. It's sometimes kind of offbeat. There was somebody who was tweeting about it that, you know, they had gone into this library and out of everything, this embarrassment of riches, they wound up watching Tequila Sunrise with Michelle Pfeiffer and Kurt Russell and Mel Gibson, which is not necessarily a classic.
Not a major film.
But there it is.
Laurence Olivier's Hamlet or Tequila Sunrise.
Absolutely. So I very much have been enjoying that service. You know, I have too many streaming services, but for the time being, that's one that I've been getting a lot out of. So Filmstruck, the streaming service, and that is what is making me happy this week. That brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, Glenn at GH Weldon, and Daisy at Run DMR, best handle in the business. You can follow our producer Jessica _ Reedy and our producer emeritus and music director Mike Katziff at Mike Katziff, KATZIF. Mike's band, Hello, Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are tapping your foot to right now. Thanks to all of you for being here.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening. We will see you right back here next week.
What's unique about the human experience, and what do we all have in common? I'm Guy Raz. Every week on TED Radio Hour, we go on a journey through the big ideas, emotions, and discoveries that fill all of us with wonder. Find it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.